Accession number 27091, reel number 5, Mr. Ken Bean. We're talking about how you joined HMS Tyne, the destroyer depot ship, in Glasgow in November 1944. Now, what I mean, we talked a bit about conditions on the ship. We'll save some of that for later. But what happened next? Where did you go from Glasgow?
I joined the Tyne, I remember, on a rainy November night in Glasgow, and I think the following morning the ship sailed, Greenock I suppose it was, down the Clyde, which was an area I wasn't at all familiar with, and we joined a convoy of vessels, which I suppose had assembled in that area near Ailsa. I remember seeing Ailsa Craig, I think it is, in the distance. And we set off in convoy, I suppose, of about 20 merchant ships with destroyer escorts. I don't know that we actually knew where we were going at the time, because communication wasn't perhaps the strong point of the Navy at that time, at least not in these circumstances, but we did know we were going southwards. The Tyne was a warship. She carried armaments and was regarded, I think, as a very valuable ship to the fleet, because she had so many repair facilities that were not available other than in major dockyards. For that reason, we never went anywhere without we had a destroyer escort. But when we left Glasgow, this was, as I say, in a general convoy of about 20 ships. By November 1944, the Battle of the Atlantic was well and truly won, and the ship did, and the convoy didn't come under attack, although there were warnings of U-boats in the vicinity from which we deviated. And that part of the voyage, in fact, the whole of the voyage, passed without any incident. We
Now, where were you going? What was the route you took?
Well, we went south from Glasgow, down across the English Channel into the Bay of Biscay, which was very, very calm at that time. And eventually, I do recall the weather getting slowly warmer and seeing the stars in the sky change their position. We passed through the Straits of Gibraltar. We didn't stop at Gib, and we continued passage eastwards across the Mediterranean. Again, the war in the Mediterranean was largely over and won by that time, although we didn't know it. We were coming towards within a few months of the end of the European War. I recall we passed relatively close to what was then called the Italian island of Pantelleria, and there was a question that there were still German aircraft there which might attack the convoy, but again it didn't happen. So we continued sailing across the Med, and the first port of call really was Port Said, where we stayed, I suppose, 24 hours, and then embarked on the passage through the Suez Canal. Although I'd been abroad to Europe as a schoolboy, I'd never been further than France or Belgium, and these were all new venues for me, as it were. The weather obviously got quite warm by this time, and in the Red Sea, I remember, there was a very strong but very hot wind blowing. So the passage continued through the Suez Canal, through the Red Sea, and across the, I'm not sure what sea that would have been, but the next port of call was Aden, which was, again, I recollect seeing a very hot-looking place, quite still in the morning heat, going ashore there. I can't remember too much about it, because we didn't get really straight go very far, but I remember talking to people, RAF people who were stationed there, who said, it wasn't really the place to be from a climate point of view. We didn't stay long in Aden, and again continued a passage, this time going across the Indian Ocean, and arriving eventually in Trincomalee, which as it was then, I think it may well still be known as Trincomalee, and in, of course, what was known as the island of Ceylon.
Now, how long did it take? Was it still November, or were you drifting to December?
The passage from the UK to Trincomalee would have taken, I suppose, about 3 weeks, because it would have been about mid-December by the time we arrived in Ceylon. And we stayed there some weeks. I think it was after Christmas when we left.
How did you acclimatise to the hot climate?
Well, bearing in mind that I have had at that time slightly different colour hair. It was more auburn and ginger. My skin was a bit sensitive to the sun. In the Mediterranean, I remember not so much from sun, but from wind, getting sort of heat blisters. But from a personal point of view, it was a slow acclimatisation. And the sun never really bothered me in that respect, or the heat didn't bother me. Ships, of course, were not air-conditioned, and it was fairly steamy below decks. We stayed in Trincomalee for, I suppose, about 3 weeks.
And what were you doing there?
Not very much. Not very much. It's often been said that in wartime, large, whatever station of war you're in, or whatever station, whatever one of the services, much of the time is boredom. And it was, that does come back to me, that it was pretty tedious, because although there were shore runs in Trincomalee, most of the time, in fact all the time, the ship was just, as we used to say, swinging round the buoy. Not alongside, but in harbour. At anchor.
Now, what was it like ashore in Trincomalee? It's the first time in a really foreign place for a period of time.
My recollections of where we went ashore was really to a swimming beach. And in fact, there was one incident which was nothing to do with the hazards, particularly of war. You might think surprising, but when I joined the Navy, I couldn't swim, in spite of having going through in the early stages in Collingwood. You did have to do a sort of test in a tank with a life belt on, but I was sort of beginning to think I could swim, and in fact off one of the beaches of Trincomalee I got into difficulties, and Then the coasts of Ceylon, I think, are very, or Sri Lanka, as I should now say, I think are very noted for currents which can cause problems, and I did get out of my depth. Fortunately, there was one of my messmates, in fact one or two of them close at hand, that rendered the necessary assistance, but I often think about that had they not been, I probably wouldn't have been around today. I haven't got much other impressions of Trincomalee, apart from the local native population, as we would have called them in those days, who were prone to eating betel nut. And this was a nut that produced a juice that made the whole of the mouth look totally red and bloodied. And that was very, very common to the people of Trincomalee. Or Ceylon, I suppose. The one other factor as far as that period is concerned is that, bearing in mind the Tyne had her accompanying flotillas of destroyers, we were the most important ship, or the largest ship, I suppose. We had Admiral's quarters on board, in which any occasion when the crews of the destroyers would have been addressed would always have taken place on board Tyne. And in fact, we did have one such occasion when, as he became Lord Mountbatten came on board. He was, I can't exactly remember his title at that time. he would have been an admiral, but he came on board Tyne to address the men of the destroyer flotillas and, of course, our own ship's company. And I can still remember how everyone was, all the ship's company and the men from the, certainly one or at least of the flotillas of destroyers came on board. It was a very crowded occasion. And we were all mustered, as we would have said, awaiting his visit. He was a bit late, but when he did come, he came, as I suppose, really conformed with his reputation in a very casual and, we might say now, laid-back manner. He came on board, he had to speak from a podium, he ran rather than walked, and what he did was then to tell the assembled company that where the fleet was going and why it was going. So that was an illustration of communication. Remember, at this time, the ship, the Tyne, and all the destroyers and the other warships were part of what was then the East Indies Fleet. And Mountbatten came to tell us that we were going into the Pacific and we were going to form the British Pacific Fleet, which would take part in the war as it was. We didn't know then the final stages of the war against Japan. The Tyne and other repair ships were to form part of what was known, what was to be known as the Fleet Train. Now, this was a totally new conception for the Royal Navy and was essentially an American idea. When the ships got to the Pacific, they were going to have to stay at sea for long periods of time and be supported by the resources of the fleet train. I think it's true to say that warships of the home fleet and the Mediterranean fleet did not stay at sea for weeks at a time. Mostly they would be for short periods. But bearing in mind that the bases for the Pacific fleet were going to be well distant from the fighting areas, the fleet train was essential, and it, as I say, was an American idea which the Royal Navy adopted. So shortly afterwards, we left, I think it was certainly after Christmas of 1944, we sailed from Ceylon. We'd been in harbour, I think, for at least 3 weeks, although again my memory on the actual time is a bit hazy, but I know when you go to sea after a period in harbour, there's always that little adjustment of the leg, so to speak, before you totally at home. And we set sail, and we were then making our course was for Fremantle in Western Australia. And we arrived, I suppose, the passage from Ceylon, which the Tyne made alone, apart from one fleet destroyer which accompanied us. The passage would have taken, I suppose, 7 to 10 days.
That would be exact. Into January 45.
That would be into January, yes. Anything
about the voyage? Or was it
well, right? Two things about that passage. Although the Indian Ocean, I suppose, at that time was relatively free of Japanese submarines, we did have one occasion when, I can't remember the name of the destroyer who accompanied us, but where they obviously got a ping, as they called it, and they dropped a few depth charges, and we carried on. But there couldn't have been a great deal of danger at that time, because you might think extraordinarily, but when the ship crossed the line, we did actually have a crossing the line ceremony, which of course in those days was usual, certainly for passenger ships, but I don't know about warships.
Now, what was it like? Because we hear about these things, but what's the detail of it?
When we arrived at the equator, there's a lot of preparation, I believe, had gone into this beforehand, and The ship actually was briefly stopped in the early hours of the morning, or in the early morning rather, of the day we crossed the line, so that Father Neptune in, could come on board. And more or less the whole day was given over to the ritual of the shaving and the ducking in a pool that had been set up for that purpose. In fact, I've still got a booklet that was issued at the time, along with the other souvenirs. I do remember that we had Lieutenant Commander Grace. I might have mentioned his name before. He was Lieutenant Commander who was a grandson of the famous W.G. Grace. And I think Father Neptune and his court, who were, of course, petty officers and seamen, who'd been across the line before, decided that he'd committed some sort of particular error and he got a special ducking. But that was an event that was, I say, it was an indication. There was little fear of attack from any source there, because you just don't stop warships at sea if under those circumstances.
Was it fun, the ceremony? I mean, what exactly did you do? What happened to you? It was your first.
Well, everyone went through this period, went through this pantomime, let's call it, where you went into. Let me just say, they had been set up on part of the ship in the well deck, I think, some sort of bath created by with canvas sides, and they'd got enough water in it to duck people as they went in. At one end, Father Neptune, or King Neptune, I suppose, and his court were seeing everyone as they came along, all the ship's company who had crossed the line before, and you went into the pool and you were ducked and you got a bit of lather. And so it was what they called in the Navy skylarking in those days. But it passed the day, and of course the ship was underway again by this time, and it was a bit of, I think they thought it was a bit of light-hearted relief, and obviously it was an exercise that people do, if in those days, certainly on merchant ships, underwent. I've got a certificate upstairs to indicate that I'm now being looked after by all the dolphins and denizens of the sea if I ever fall overboard. So that was light relief.
What happened when you got to Fremantle?
Fremantle, in a sense, was a bit of a letdown because we could not go ashore. Fremantle, you may know, is the port adjacent to Perth, the big, large city of Western Australia. We stayed there merely, I think, overnight, and were underway again the following day. Passage was then set for Sydney, New South Wales. So we set sail down the Western Australian coast and into the Great Australian Bight, where the weather was probably as bad as any that I experienced in the Navy during that time. We were accompanied, I remember, by one, if not two, of the Lend-Lease American destroyers. They were known as flush deckers. And again, rumour was often the only way that information was passed, but it was said that somebody was lost overboard from one of these flush decker destroyers during the night. Whether that was true, I can't be sure.
What was the storm like?
Well, you have to remember that Tyne was a ship of 10 or 12,000 tonnes. She was built as a cruiser, and having a lot of heavy machinery, she was what we would have called a good sea boat. She behaved very well in storms, but it was biggish seas, I suppose, and high wind. And of course, that the Great Australian Bight is an area of sea that is known for that sort of those sort of conditions, because there is absolutely no landmass at all between anywhere around the globe. I think you've got probably the tail of South America is the only landmass that would stop the seas going round. And as you know, the Great Southern Ocean is notorious for those sort of seas. And I think the Great Australian Bight tend to get the tail end of storms which have been raging around Cape Horn. But it didn't last very long, and we continued on passage to Sydney. And as a young man of 20, I think I was at the time, having been not in onerous conditions, but been amongst places that weren't particularly welcoming, to come into the wonderful harbour of Sydney was an experience I shan't forget. Many people today go to Australia and they fly. In fact, my wife and I went to Australia in 1987 and we flew in a rainstorm. It is not the way to arrive. The way to arrive is on a ship and to sail through the Heads. And it's quite an experience. To us on board the ship, it seemed like arriving at Shangri-La. And in fact, because the Tyne was one of the most important ships certainly in the fleet train, we tied up in Circular Quay, which is where all the big liners go today. So we're in a position of some prominence. The stay in Sydney was short. We were there, I think, a week. Time to just look around the city, not to really make any friends. I suppose we weren't there at that time for that purpose. And the fleet train then, ships of the fleet train, not all of them, set sail for the island of Manus, or Manus in the Admiralty Islands, which was, again, about a 7-8 day passage northwards, a passage along the eastern Australian coast, skirting, I suppose, the Great Barrier Reef and up past New Guinea. And Manus was an island virtually located on the equator. I think it had been an American base. In fact, it still was an American base. And the American forces had made the anchorage facilities available to the British Pacific Fleet. I should say that...
Now, who was with you at this time? Was this where the fleet were, or what was happening?
The main fleet had gone forward by this time and would have either been involved in operations at sea, or some of the ships were in the Admiralty Islands by the time we got there. I should say that these were things that we didn't particularly know at the time, because communication wasn't awfully good in telling you who you were and what you were and what you were doing. But the British Pacific Fleet was known really as Task Force 57, and we were part really of the major fleets under the general guidance of Admiral Horsey. It's been written, and I know this is true, that there were certain of the higher-ups in the United States forces who didn't really welcome the British taking part in the Pacific War. They felt it was an American theatre of war, and apart from our involvement in Burma and the East Indies, they didn't welcome us too much. Admiral King, I believe, was notable for this. But on the other hand, Admiral Halsey and Spruance and the other principal American admirals were very welcoming, and they did all they could, really, to make facilities available to the British fleet. Going back to the Tyne, we stayed again in Manus for 2 or 3 weeks. It seemed a long time at the time. Once again, the principal enemy was boredom. We didn't go ashore. We weren't allowed ashore. Perhaps there were no facilities.
Was there much work for you to do, in the sense of, you know, the destroyer's wireless is breaking down?
There wasn't a great deal of work. There wasn't really much, not at this stage. A little later on there was. As for entertainment, the radio was our entertainment, and we really were reliant on the local American forces network, which were found in every location in the Pacific. There was a station everywhere. I can still remember that it was WVTD, as they called it, the Voice of the Admiralties, on the air from Admiralty Square. That was the local American announcers. And, of course, they played records all day long and chat and so on. I remember things that are probably inconsequential, but they used to broadcast, I suppose, principally to their own forces and anybody that did go ashore, that there was the main health dangers there were from a disease called schistosomiasis, and you may be surprised that I still remember that after all these years. But it was a disease that you could get through going in swamp water, but it didn't happen for us because we never went ashore. We stayed there about three weeks, and to the delight of everybody, we went back to Sydney, this time for a month. And the reason for that was because, no doubt, the war was moving further northwards in the Pacific, and the fleet train really went back to replenish for a time before going again further north. We spent a month in Sydney, and from a personal point of view, it was very nice because the Australians, who had previously had the Americans there in 42 and 43, were very welcoming through an organisation which was known as the British Centre. I and one or two of my friends in the mess met one particular Australian family who made us very welcome. They had a house in a suburb called Croydon, and another place at the most, the most expensive beach in Sydney, in Palm Beach. They had a house there, so we were well looked after in that time. And it was...
Were the Australians generally welcoming? I mean, was there any trouble ashore?
Well, there were odd cases of people who got in trouble. I can remember there were a couple of lads in the mess who were blacksmiths who got in some sort of trouble and were taken in by the police and got beaten up by the police. And they were the exception, I suppose. Generally, it depends where you went and what part of the suburbs of Sydney you visited. King's Cross and Paddington, I think, were the notorious places for trouble in Sydney, but by and large, people didn't get involved, and they were generally the Australians, certainly the people that we met through the British Centre, were very welcoming.